The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Thank you, David. It's a magnificent story, terrifying in many ways, the account of Exodus. I actually read these chapters that deal with the plagues that God sends upon Pharaoh and upon Egypt in the trip from Kalara to Winyard. It was exactly the same period of time. Get you through those five or six chapters. And I think if I sat down now and we all just had a reading from that gripping story, it may actually go much better. But I won't do that. It's more important that I speak. And so if you do get something from this passage, I hope it's to go away and to read it for yourself and to think. Because it describes a world which is in many ways terrifying. You see in that opening chapter, as we did last week, the little Hebrew boys being thrown into the Nile. Can you imagine infants being killed for political advantage? Can you imagine a country which is fearful of foreigners, so fearful that it will enslave them? Can you imagine that kind of fear that this group within the nation might turn against you, and the political, ruthless logic that leads people to say it's better that these children are drowned in order that I might preserve my power? That's the world of Exodus. It's the world where rulers are not seeing anything that they're held to account beyond themselves. It's said in the ancient civilization, the greatest power there of Egypt, but follows instead a group of immigrants from the land of Canaan, strangers and outsiders with different customs and beliefs, who quickly find themselves targets of prejudice, as we can all too easily imagine, victims of a tyrannical pharaoh, turned into slaves, press-ganged into making some of the buildings that would still be standing there today. But there is that dark turn in chapter 1 where the Hebrew children, the boys, are thrown into the Nile to drown, the moment where slavery darkens into genocide. But we can't deal with it in cartoonish kind of ways. It's not that Pharaoh is the most evil character that you get through the Old Testament. There's others who easily would qualify for that role, a Haman in Esther, say, who seems genuinely psychopathic in the way he exercises his power. Here, instead, there is this ruthless, whatever-it-takes kind of logic to the infanticide. It's that the death of the infants is the price that needs to be paid for political security. By first ordering the midwives to kill all the male Israelite babies, when that had failed, commanding every boy must be cast into the Nile, Pharaoh turns the heart of Egypt itself, the Nile, with all that brings in terms of its riches, with all that brings in terms of making Egypt what it was, with all that they understood it to be in terms of it being a symbol for life, instead becomes this symbol for death. The midwives who are supposed to bring life into being instead be the ones who are turned into being agents of death. Pharaoh is inverting the blessings of nature itself in order to bring upon this culture of death, and he's using the law to do it. It's all done according to law. Pharaoh wants to hold these midwives to account when he hears that some Hebrew boys have escaped his terrible judgment. Pharaoh sees himself as the one who is free to do this because he is the one with all power. All freedom, all power collapse just into himself. He is the one who's on the top of the pyramid, so to speak. The one who can decide life and death for others, the one who can write whatever law he wants, the one who does not fear the living God but speaks instead for all the gods. And yet there is an underclass that we see. These group of midwives who come, and we saw that last week, they're the ones who are described as fearing the living God and so disobeying Pharaoh's laws, practicing civil disobedience. And we see too that the great character who doesn't walk explicitly into the stage of Exodus is the living God himself, who hears the cries of his people and who is concerned for the weak and the powerless and steps into history to answer those prayers and does it by sending Moses in. Even before Moses comes before Pharaoh, he's told what is going to happen. So let me read to you a section from Exodus chapter 4, where Moses himself out in the wilderness is told this. The Lord said to Moses, "When you return to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders that I've given you the power to do. But I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. Then say to Pharaoh, this is what the Lord says. Israel is my firstborn son, and I have told you, let my son go so he may worship me. But you refuse to let him go, so I will kill your firstborn son." The message is given to him to pass on, let my people go. He's told that he'll have wonders to show. And we're told as well, we're introduced to this idea that Pharaoh's heart will be hardened so that he won't let the people go. Even before Moses says a word to Pharaoh, he's told this is what the response is going to be. But notice most of all that God here is claiming Israel as his son. They do not belong to Egypt. This is not Pharaoh's son. This is not Pharaoh's slave. These are the sons of God. Israel is the son of God. And he gives this command to Pharaoh, let my people go. Here is a claim to sovereignty. Here is a claim where God is saying, I am the one who is free, and I am the one who issues commands that you must follow. The sending of the plagues will demonstrate that. Now, the idea that God is the one who is sovereign easily slips off the tongue here and fits into our way of thinking, because the Bible has so influenced our way of thinking what God is like. Whether you believe in God or you don't believe in God, the fact is when we talk about God, we mostly are thinking in biblical Christian kind of categories. And so the idea that God is the one who is all-powerful and is everywhere is a very biblical, monotheistic way of understanding God. It's not an Egyptian way. It's not an ancient way. It's not a pagan way. In the ancient world, each nation had its own God, with limited sovereignty, limited jurisdictions. They were gods of this place or that, and they might be seen in a river or a frog or in a doorway, you know, and you could have a god who is the god of doorways. You know, as you walk in and out of a doorway, there's a god that you need. And so you look around the creation, and each part of it is imbued with a spiritual kind of significance, but you also see that these gods are very limited in what they can do. And so as Moses comes to Pharaoh and says, let my people go, the response is, no surprise, one of kind of a baffled Egyptian one. This is what the Lord says, the God of Israel, let my people go so they may hold a festival for me in the desert. That's chapter 5. And Pharaoh's immediate response is, who is the Lord that I should obey him and let Israel go? I don't know the Lord. I will not let Israel go. It's not that he hadn't probably heard of this Hebrew God, because he was terrified of the numbers of them that were increasing. He would have known about their beliefs. It's that he doesn't recognize his sovereignty. Within Egypt, the Egyptians' gods rule. Who is the Lord that I should be worried about him at all? Moses comes with a claim that God is the God who is not bound by territory, but a God of anywhere and a God of everywhere. And the point of the plagues will be to show this to an Egyptian ruler who doesn't believe it. They will demonstrate that God is the great one whose name needs to be proclaimed through all the earth. The point here is not just a theological one, it's political as well, in terms of the claim of who gets to make the laws for all the people who are there. Who is the one who has that right and who has that freedom. And throughout the next few chapters, we see this. By the way, this photograph may actually be the historical pharaoh we're talking about. There's some contest about dates and which pharaoh is which. If not, take it as an illustrative photo of a pharaoh that they've found and dug up. Not suitable for work and children, so I'll flick on. And you start going through this series of plagues. And this is where I am going to need you to go away and read it. We just don't have time to go through each of them. But a series of plagues which will come. And with each of them, there is this hardening of Pharaoh's heart. Sometimes God hardens it. Sometimes it's described that Pharaoh hardens his own heart. But there is this tragedy that takes place. And Pharaoh is like Lady Macbeth, like Captain Ahab. There's this destiny that he seems drawn to, where he stubbornly kind of locks into this obstinate refusal to listen to Moses and drags the nation down into this awful judgment. And so you see the, you know, water turned to blood, the plague of frogs, the plague of lice, the plague of flies, the livestock which die, the boils which break out, the hail, which is greater than any storm that had taken place. With that one, Moses says, look, it's coming. And by that time, some of the Egyptians are starting to listen. When they hear that word, they put their, the ones who believe it, put their animals under shelter and get some protection. But the ones who want to not believe it face that judgment. And so you see this escalation of locusts that takes place, darkness, which happens. And plague after plague is sent against them. And the thing that we may not recognise, but the Egyptians would have straight away, was that in each of those different spheres, there were gods that they believed and worshipped. And the symbolism of these plagues lost on us was obvious to them. The Nile itself, turned to blood, was personified as a god who was worshipped, the source of fertility in what was otherwise a great desert region. Still is true. Offerings were made to it as it flooded. The plague of frogs, associated with a god of fertility, which attended births as a midwife, depicted as a woman with the head of a frog. And so, yes, you see these plagues which come as a punishment, in a way, against Pharaoh for the mistreatment of the Israelites. But it also shows the powerlessness of the gods of Egypt in which they believed. There's a confrontation that's taken place between the empty idols, which are shown to be have no power, and the one living God who loves his children and operates to save them. And this very different understanding of God starts to impact on Egypt itself and their relationship to Pharaoh. So even some of Pharaoh's closest staffers, by the time that these later plagues come, will be brave enough to say, let the people go so that they might worship the Lord their God. Don't you yet realise that Egypt is ruined? You know, some of the staffers who were probably handing out the advice saying, well, here's how we can conduct infanticide against these children, then are brought to the point where they are seeing the living God at action. The magicians who are trying to keep up with Moses and Aaron give up. And they say, well, we can't even produce a gnat. This is the finger of the living God at work here. Who are we against it? This ninth plague of darkness, think what that says to a nation that thinks that the supreme God is the sun god and that Pharaoh is the son of the sun god. Here he is, the one who seems to have all power, seems to be all almighty, instead being left in the dark. And then this terrible last plague, where God says in chapter 12, I will pass through Egypt on that night, I will kill every firstborn in Egypt, man and animal. I'll perform acts of judgment against all the gods of Egypt. I alone am God. The explanation which is given, that God is actually executing judgment against the gods of Egypt. It's not a gladiatorial kind of contest in which the strongest power wins. There's a morality at work here that God cares about what's taking place and he won't just let this pass. And it's seen supremely in the death of the firstborn that takes place. I say that as a firstborn. Can you just put your hand up quickly if you're a firstborn? Yeah. Can you imagine that across a nation, that the firstborn will die? The scale of that is hard to imagine. And yet, God, in a way, is bringing judgment against the one who would so quickly kill the infants to say, you'll have that judgment brought upon yourself. The one who's shed the blood of these children, well, you will suffer that. And only that, perhaps, will bring you to an understanding of what takes place. In this plague, it's not just that, you know, God has power over the sun god, it's the rejection by God of a way of doing civilization that says it's okay to have a ruler who claims all power to himself, who claims to act freely of him, who claims to have this life and death power over the innocent children. God is saying, I'm the God who loves and cares for his children. I'm not the one who kills his children. I'm the one who will save the ones who are in that distress. And the awful climax of the Passover is the moment that Pharaoh will relent, that the people will go, that Israel will always remember. Literally, their calendar is reset with the Passover. The angel of death, which comes throughout the land, and the firstborn will die. But the angel will pass over the land of the Israelites who follow God's command to put the blood of the lamb upon the doorpost. As they do that, they're passed over. They're spared. They're always to remember that. They're always to tell their children that that had taken place. The precepts for how to celebrate it are given even before the act actually takes place. That's how significant it is. And more than 1,000 years later, it's still being celebrated and through different civilizations coming and bringing their own power to bear over Israel. They, as a nation, celebrated that night and that moment as the thing which had brought them life and freedom from tyranny. And over 1,000 years later, Jesus calls his followers together into an upper room and celebrated that Passover as they had for the last 1,000-plus years. And brought together the elements by which they celebrate it and said, remember the way that God has done this. A lamb was killed at the time of Passover, and it's the night before the killing of the lambs when that takes place. And Jesus says, look, we need to be ready for that. And he takes the symbols of remembrance and says, these are really about me. The ultimate act of cultural appropriation. Jesus says, this thing that you celebrate for 1,000 years to say this is what God's salvation looks like, well, in fact, it's something that points to me. It'd be like us talking about Anzac Day and saying, that thing which you remember, it's actually all about me. you'd be sacked from SBS if you did something like that, right? Jesus says, that whole history is something which is just the shadow, which is pointing to the reality which I'm going to live out. That in my broken body, in my shed blood, in the death of this firstborn, you will find salvation. You will find freedom. You will find God's rescue at work for the weak and for the otherwise hopeless. Here alone, in the blood which is shed and put not on a doorpost but upon a cross, there is a shadow from God's terrible judgment. Exodus inverts the expectations of who has power and who has freedom. It's that you don't expect to look at Pharaoh and to say, here is the one who is a slave, and yet he clearly was a slave who was unable to break out of the bad, evil, terrible things that he did. The one who said he had all power and didn't need to worry about justice was the one who was shown to be a slave of those passions. And Moses, as he stands before Pharaoh, the one with faltering lips who says that he's unable to do anything at all, the one who's a representative of the slave people, is the one who will lead his people to freedom. And so too, you see the one who's condemned as criminal and given a gruesome kind of death that the Romans wouldn't give to a Roman citizen, the one who's despised and killed outside the city, is the one who looks as though he has no freedom, and yet freely he steps into that moment. The one who looks like he has no power is the one who is given all power, the one who acts in that kind of humility. There's a reversal and inversion of expectations. And it's a very humbling and sobering word for those of us who want to claim power in this world, who want to say we're able to act without impunity. And as we are in a city at the moment whose parliament is grappling with the ideas of what do we do with the infants amongst us, how do we deal with justice in this kind of situation with the abortion bill, which is before the parliament, it's a terrifying prospect to look at passages like this and to say there is a living God who cares for little ones. You cannot act with impunity. Justice is bigger than whatever law you choose to make. There is a humbling word that comes from God here as a warning of what might come. I put it no stronger than that, but these passages still speak and they should still lead us to great humility and prayers for wisdom for us and for our rulers at this time. I'm going to stop there. I'm going to give you a chance for questions about passage where we've been going. Okay, first question is a great one. If God hardens Pharaoh's heart, how can he still be judged as responsible for his actions? That's a good question, but it's also one which you can't help but ask chapter after chapter. And the author of Exodus foregrounds that question for us. It's not as though, oh, here's something you haven't thought of. It's that this very issue is brought to the foreground, that God does do these things because he's the one who acts with all kind of sovereignty. And I think unlike kind of Greek philosophy, unlike systematic attempts to kind of nail down that relationship between sovereignty and freedom and human responsibility and agency that in neat kind of philosophical categories, we instead have a story which tells how that dilemma is lived out. And at its heart, there's a tension between a pharaoh who says, I am free, and a biblical account which says, well no, you're not. And whatever account we have of freedom can't be an unqualified one that says God is just like the river or a frog. You cannot step outside the real universe which we're in, God's universe and his creation, to be free of him. So whatever freedom means, it can't be freedom from his moral universe. So we can't say yes to an unqualified kind of freedom. But at the same time, there is a genuine responsibility where people are held to account for their own moral choices. And so there are times through this account where Pharaoh does take responsibility clearly, and Pharaoh hardens his own heart, it says. So you have both things at work. You have that God is sovereign, that this is his universe. We're not as free as we would think we are. And yet at the same time, there is a responsibility to act in ways which accord with that reality. We're not to be throwing infants into rivers and drowning them, you know. And so the New Testament will pick up this as well and say that Pharaoh is the ultimate example of saying that God is the one who molds us like an artisan will mold bits of pottery out of clay. Now, it's a very humbling thing to hear that and to think that maybe I don't have the freedom that I thought I did. Maybe I'm not the one who's as all-powerful as I thought I was, and maybe there is a God who has made me and who will hold me to account. Now, I can't give you a neat philosophical answer for all that. I think the better thing is to read the narrative and to see how it's expressed. And I want to say it's the best story the human race has going of how to hold those things in tension. What do we do with the pharaohs of our times that do not know the Lord? Chapter 5, verse 2. What does "let my people go" mean in 2019? Can we separate ourselves from a pharaoh society? Should we? Why do so many, especially nominal Christians, think they will escape God's judgment? I think we need to be slow and cautious in too quickly identifying ourselves as Moses and a political leader as Pharaoh. Tempting as that is sometimes, I'm regularly walking into Parliament, meeting with different staffers and MPs. There are some staffers who I think would be all on board with the kind of Pharaoh logic that's taking place here. I think I met a lot of MPs who are much better than you might think if you just read the media. There's a real humility, I think, that's got to come to us first rather than finding fault in others. But the Word of God here, I think, tells us that God is not tribal in his concerns. You know, it's not that he's really particularly interested just in the land of Canaan and the beliefs of this people here, or that he's only interested in how Australian Christians should live, but not the rest of society. The God who is everywhere and anywhere is the God who is concerned for the hairs on the heads and the worst injustice and the concerns of the weak and the powerless and the alien and the exile. And so there is no kind of square inch of the world that we can say, well, that's not the concern of God. And so humbly, I think we need to be able to speak into that kind of thing and to be able to say this is not special pleading as we think about the issues of 2019, but instead it's being humble and saying that God is the one who cares about this. Not being caught up in the power games that the staffers might want to play. So I feel like that turned more into a confession time for myself than an answer to your question, but if that was helpful. Two questions. Timing. Why didn't God act to free the Israelites sooner? Yes. Why bother with these plagues at all? Like, God could have absolutely just opened the floodgates, do whatever he wanted to do, march them straight out. And yet, part of the reason that's given, and you see this in chapter 9, is that the demonstration that takes place is actually so that his name will be known throughout the world. It actually demonstrates his power. And you start to see that as Egyptians who see hail coming, listen to the word of God and obey and respond. And as the Israelites go out, they'll be plundering the Egyptians. The Egyptians will be giving them gold and silver and stuff because they recognize that God is in their midst. So I think that's part of the answer. And then a vicarious liability question. Okay. Punishment for Egypt and the Egyptians. So not just the individual judgment against Pharaoh, but a kind of corporate judgment against the nation. Yes, that's true. That we are not just individuals, that there are these things that take place here. And yet God's word actually breaks up previous loyalty. So he calls for, and the Egyptian midwives recognize this call, that they can't just obey the law of Pharaoh, that they actually fear the Lord more and therefore they disobey the law of Pharaoh. When the word comes about the hail coming, people will say, well, I want to listen to Moses and Aaron and not the word of Pharaoh at that point. So it challenges the loyalties that we might have. Who has the authority of judgment and justice? Is it God or government? In Hong Kong's current democratic movement, government made the judgment instead of God. How can you approve it, I think? God appoints rulers to do justice, you know? And so you see in Romans chapter 13 that there's no ruler on earth that hasn't been appointed by God in order to act justly. And they're given a sword of justice in order to do that. And we're held to account if we don't follow that ruler, and they're held to account if they don't act in ways which are just. And so it's not a, you know, either theocracy divorced from human government. That's not actually the biblical model. The biblical model is that God actually uses human rulers, and not just his own kings, but throughout the nations. That's true. That there's no ruler who's not held to account for the way that they exercise judgment. That includes China. And so the great terror which is taking place within the Chinese state at the moment is that people won't give their ultimate loyalty to the state. They know the power of that, and they rightly kind of fear it. It's true not just in Hong Kong. It's also true for the Uyghur, who are mostly Muslim, but there's some Christian there as well. And beware of the state that claims to act in the place of God, to have all power like that. Exodus is a warning for us to exercise humility. There's much more to be said about Hong Kong, but we could say at least that. Parliamentary democracy has developed in part to prevent civil war. Differing views have to be handled in some way. Christians are taught to appreciate opposing views should they become more dogmatic. I'm not sure about the dogmatic point, but yes, in a parliamentary democracy, we do need to say there are different groups who have different accounts of how to do life. And so we need a kind of freedom in democracy to allow for that. And not to just say religion is just an expression of ethnicity, but to say people have different ways of understanding communion with God, and it's not the role of the state to make that judgment and to say, you know, here is the way to worship and no other. In the wisdom of the constitutional drafters, Section 116 gives space for competing visions and belief and freedom to live that out. And so right now we're having conversations between those different groups as to what that looks like. And a Christian view on that will be that it can't be a winner-takes-all, zero-sum gain. We get to write the rules for the nation. Instead, it's a humble kind of placement in this order as we, you know, wait for the future to say rulers are there to do justice for all. And we come in good faith with different faiths to a common table. We're able to do life together with very different beliefs. Short answer to a good question. Thanks, mate.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.